TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
The Pentagon, Climate Change, War, and U.S. Military Emissions. Nita Crawford, Professor in International Relations at the University of Oxford. She co-founded the Costs of War Project at Brown University in 2010 and currently serves as a project co-director. Nita Crawford spoke at the Mahindra Center at Harvard University on September 29, 2022. She was introduced by Makeda Best, curator of photography at the Harvard Art Museums.
I first learned about Dr. Crawford's research and on the military's use of fossil fuels in 2019 when I read her paper, Pentagon Fuel Use, Climate Change, and the Costs of War. I was acquiring photographs for the Harvard Art Museums that depicted a region in central Louisiana where there is a large concentration of fossil fuel production. Stacy Kranitz's deep, dense compositions of fences and foliage are emblematic of what Dr. Crawford describes in her current book as the deep cycle, or the relationship between economic growth, fossil fuel use, American wars, and foreign oil dependency. Indeed, by recognizing the fact that these corporations operate on the same lands where enslaved peoples once worked, Kranitz deepens the connections to histories of war and economic power. Dr. Crawford introduced me to the concept of climate change as a threat multiplier, and thus I began to see works like Kranitz's as landscapes of war. In her 2019 paper, Dr. Crawford pointed out that the U.S. is preparing for threats of attack from human adversaries. While global warming is the most certain and immediate of any of the threats the U.S. faces over the next several decades. Now, with such events as the publication of the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and the ongoing Russian war on Ukraine have prompted renewed discussions of oil, conflict, and climate, Dr. Crawford has published her new book, The Pentagon, Climate Change and War. The book provides perspectives on the links between the U.S. military and mainstream climate science, for example, and an especially enlightening section to me was her writing on the ways the military influenced the development of modern climate science. After she earned her PhD in political science from MIT, Dr. Crawford embarked on an extraordinarily prolific career of writing for scholarly journals and general interest media, including the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and the Chronicle of Higher Education. In addition to the book we've all gathered here to hear about today, Dr. Crawford is the author of Accountability for Killing, Moral Responsibility for Collateral Damage in America's Post-9/11 Wars, published in 2013. She was a co-winner of the 2003 American Political Science Association's Jervis and Schroeder Award for Best Book in Environmental History and Politics. Consistent in her scholarship is her interest in competing values and notions of individual and collective moral responsibility. As she has written, quote, military organizations are moral agents, and a focus on pathways for institutional change. Another notable feature of Dr. Crawford's work is the sheer amount of data she offers. One of her peers made the observation that, quote, she single-handedly gathers and analyzes data of such a vast quantity that the result resembles an NGO rather than an individual. It's not an NGO, but Dr. Crawford is also one of the founders of the Cost of War Project at Brown University's Watson Institute, which she co-directs with Catherine Lutz and Stephanie Saville. Begun in 2010, the team includes 50 scholars, legal experts, human rights practitioners, and physicians. Costs of War uses research and their website to, quote, foster democratic discussion of the post-9/11 wars in Iraq and Afghanistan by providing the fullest possible account of their human, economic, and political costs, and to foster better informed public policies. Dr. Crawford is a Montague Burton Chair in International Relations at Oxford University. Previously, she was professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Boston University. And since 2017, she has served on the board of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Advocacy Organization, Council for a Livable World. Please welcome Dr. Crawford.
You know, that introduction was really beautiful, and I thank you for it. But I want to begin by saying thanks to all of you who are my friends and colleagues who've come to this event. What I want to do today is run through some of the major arguments in this book, which I wrote for MIT Press, and I thank Anthony Zanino and my acquiring editor Beth Clevenger, I don't know if you're here, but thank you so much for forcing me to write it, basically at knife point, really fast. So all errors are there, my fault. Okay, so the theme that I'm gonna talk about today, the scale of US military missions, I'm just gonna give you some data and go very quickly through that, because what I really wanna get at is this deep cycle that was mentioned earlier, war as a driver of emissions and industrialization. And then I'd like to talk about the military's role in climate science and climate change negotiations, again, breezing through that very quickly and talk about how the military thinks about climate change, get to the fact that there's securitization and militarization, I'm gonna explain those terms, happening right now, and it has been for the last 50 years, with the military and climate change. And then I'll talk about the way that military is thinking about resilience and adaptation and mitigation and the question of war. So there's many ways to think about emissions. Last year, the Pentagon's emissions were 51 million metric tons. The year before that, they were 51 million metric tons. In 2019, they were 54 or 55 million metric tons CO2 equivalent. And that's enormous. And what I wanted to do with this slide is basically just have you think about emissions per capita. The military's emissions per capita are more intense than civilian emissions. That's the point here, right? So the military is a very intensive user of fossil fuel, and military industry is as well. And what we have is a kind of perspective that I think we rarely get, which is the energy consumption of the entire US government is dominated by the Department of Defense. The Department of Defense is the world's largest greenhouse, single institutional greenhouse gas emitter. It's the United States' largest energy user, institutionally, single energy user. So the share of total US government energy consumption, it's actually declining. The DOD's energy consumption is actually declining. So it was around 87% of all US government energy consumption was the military, the DOD, and now it's about 76%, still the largest user. DOD emissions of greenhouse gases, mostly carbon, but also methane and nitrous oxide, are fluctuating. One thing to note is the overall decline since the Vietnam War. You also see spikes depending on what's happening. So there's a spike in the Reagan buildup, and there's a spike in 1991 with the Gulf War. That's the highest on the chart here, 110 million metric ton CO2 equivalent. And then it's declining until the post-9/11 wars begin. And it goes up to 85 million metric tons. Okay, but now let's think about this in another perspective. The US military emits more CO2 than many nations. Okay, the other thing we need to keep in mind is military industrial emissions. And I'm not gonna talk a lot about that today, but it's important to think about this because military emissions are part of the story, but military industrial emissions are a significant part of emissions. Mostly what I'm talking about today are the military emissions, but military industrial emissions are about the same magnitude as military emissions. Okay, so it's hard to wrap your head around it. So about 15 to 17% of the United States industrial economy is military and aerospace. Then that's based on employment. Okay, so if you do that calculation, you get a number. I did it based, an estimate based on the emissions of the top 12 defense contractors. Lockheed Martin is the largest, Northrop Grumman, General Dynamics, these are the big three. Military industrial emissions are as emitting as the DOD. So again, the size of entire countries like Denmark. Okay, so now the deep cycle, very quickly. The deep cycle is my notion, you know, thinking about international relations as I do, as something that unfolds over hundreds of years. where institutions and ideas and material reality reinforce each other. What I'm trying to describe is how the military technology and military fuel use promoted military industrialization, changed commercial, that is civilian consumption and commercial industry, affected relations between the United States or any other country and oil producing countries through bases and other kinds of arrangements, supplying weapons and so on. We begin when the United States moves away from arms and legs, and all militaries move away from arms and legs and draft horses and so on, oxen, powering them, to when they get steam engines powered by coal. So they move away from sort of natural power and the winds. And so if the wind stops blowing, the ship is becalmed. So what fuel gives you is not just speed, but independence from nature. And the tight relationship between military industry, which is also using fossil fuels to make the weapons. So Matthew Perry is an interesting figure. I have his the Japanese depiction of the forced opening of Japan, because Perry is not just trying to open commercial relationships, but he's trying to get coal depots and a coal supply in the Far East. That's part of his mission. So the U.S. also depended on British infrastructure at this time. But the British, being the largest naval power, needed their own independent infrastructure in the late 19th century, early 20th century. And they are coincidentally, and not so coincidentally, reliant on the coal that they produce. Coal and Newcastle, but coal is the thing that they have, which allows them to become dominant in this mode of transportation, steam-powered, at first steamships that are using both sails and water wheels, but then engines with propellers that are powered by steam and then later oil. So this is why people said in the 19th century that coal may be considered as the lifeblood of the man of war, and upon its supply depends their existence as a living factor in the battle equation. Here you see depicted the United States Navy's Great White Fleet, which makes a voyage between 1907 and 1908, circumnavigating the globe on coal, and they have to rely on the British to supply some of that coal, and they're trying to get local coal, and it becomes enlightening to the Roosevelt administration, and later when they realize that they can't do it all themselves, and they have an incentive to get more coal that's controlled by the United States. And this is the ironically titled Great White Fleet, which is so dirty that they had to carry around extra cans of white paint because the coal would stick to the sides of the ship. So fast forwarding to World War I, Lord Curzon says the Allies floated to victory on a wave of oil. Of course, he's the leader of the House of Lords. He's in the War Cabinet. That's partially true. They did. But they're also still dependent on coal. There's a mixture there. And after the war, what you see is the development of United States Army Air Force and aerial refueling. And ships are no longer really alone in sucking up a lot of the fuel needs. Aircraft becomes much more significant. And then quickly, I want to say something about the role of oil in World War II. Clearly, the Japanese were unhappy when the United States cut off oil exports in June 1941. Oil was one of the things that the Japanese needed for their strategy, so they tried to get it from Manchuria in the 1930s, and they were successful. But they also had other parts of their conquest strategy driven by the need for oil. The U.S. is, of course, trying to stop their access to oil, and they start sinking the Japanese ships, which have oil on them, going to Japanese military industry. In World War II, in addition, the Allies bombed the Germans because they were coal rich. They had to get oil from elsewhere. Okay, so then the deep cycle is also that work in post-war technological and social innovations that are spurred by war, promoted by military industry. For example, the commercial aircraft industry is bolstered by the giving away of aircraft after World War I and World War II to the commercial airplane industry. The U.S. highway system in the 1950s is about evacuation from the threat of nuclear war. And it's also, the highway system is meant to facilitate military industry as well. You get plastics, you get ammonium nitrate, which was used in bombs, going to soil in the form of fertilizer, and then that becomes nitrous oxide, which is a potent greenhouse gas. It's almost 300 times more potent than carbon dioxide. In addition, there's deforestation that occurs in war that's deliberate and sometimes not. And this image is of the burning of the Shenandoah Valley in 1864, deliberate burning to try to bring misery to the Confederacy, but it happens to destroy lots of forest. And you also see the way that trees were used, cut down and used to make roads, very quick roads. Taking us up to the present, the consequences of attacking oil fields, which is a strategy that doesn't just end in World War II, but continues into the Iraqi deliberate destruction of their own and Kuwaiti oil facilities, to the United States destruction of ISIS oil infrastructure, and more recently, the deliberate apparently destruction of natural gas infrastructure, Nord Stream 1 and 2. Those images are of bubbles of natural gas, which is mostly methane, a gas that is 24 times more potent, has a greater greenhouse gas intensity than carbon dioxide. Okay, that's a lot of the big picture. And what I want to do now is describe how the United States system is, this is Defense Logistics Agency distribution of fuel, and they say our footprint is global. It is. It's in every part of the world. They have this capacity to distribute, store and distribute fuel, whatever kind is needed. Navy special fuel, jet fuel, diesel fuel, and so on. And these distribution centers are at bases and in close relationship with allies. And there's about 750 US overseas bases that they're in charge of getting fuel to. Okay, so now I'm going to summarize the deep cycle of fossil fuel use, growth, and military strategy. It begins with cheap and versatile oil. It then moves to civilian and military demand for petroleum. You get dependence and the production of infrastructure. You want to maintain supply. You don't want to be vulnerable. So your concern extends to threats in the future, for instance, political instability in producing countries, increasing price, and the possibility that oil may run out. So this insecurity about price, access, and diminished supply gets you to attempts to decrease insecurity. So you increase your military capacity and presence in areas like the Persian Gulf where oil is found. You develop economic and diplomatic ties to oil producers. You choose winners and losers in those societies, and that can create instability itself. Then increased military spending, arms purchases, and the presence in oil and gas-producing regions and lines of communication create their own vulnerabilities that you have to defend against. But there's this way out that we often don't take, which is attempts to break the cycle of fossil fuel dependency, this deep cycle, by diversifying energy sources, using renewables, developing alternatives to fossil fuel technologies, and so on. And we could reduce consumption. There's an idea. Okay, so that's the deep cycle. How does the military think about national security and climate change? I want to tell you a couple things about how they think about it. First of all, they understand climate science. They anticipate its impacts, that is, climate change impact on the institution itself, and they're concerned about climate change-caused war coming to a neighborhood near you. So, how do they understand climate change? They paid for the research that tells us about it. Roger Revelle, in 1956, is asking for money to understand the impact of increased warming in the Arctic. So he says, we are now the greatest maritime nation on Earth. If the Russian coastline increases by something like 2,000 miles or so, the Russians will become a great maritime nation. Therefore, he needs money to study climate change. And Revelle and co-author Hans Suess, in research funded by the Department of the Navy, write in 1957 in a scientific journal, human beings are now carrying out a large-scale geophysical experiment of a kind that could not have happened in the past, nor be reproduced in the future. Within a few centuries, we are returning to the atmosphere and oceans the concentrated organic carbon stored in sedimentary rocks over hundreds of millions of years. Some of these same people, including Roger Revelle, tell President Johnson that they're engaged in this experiment, and on, they tell Carter. Okay, fast forwarding to 1997, there's an opportunity in the international community to understand and reduce global greenhouse gas emissions. And it's negotiations in Kyoto. The Pentagon says they don't want anything. They want to be exempted from any emissions reductions or even reporting. Then they lobby. President Clinton agrees. Al Gore agrees. They get what they call everything they wanted in terms of not having reporting. Essentially, it's saying the United States does not have to, nor does any other country, according to the Kyoto Protocol, say what its military emissions are. If they talk about military, any sort of military-related emissions, they can concatenate it, put it in with commercial aircraft emissions, for example, so you wouldn't know what was military, what was civilian. So this is the way it works. In 2015, at Paris, the far right was concerned that this would go away, this opacity. And they lobbied, and it's now voluntary that a country could tell their emissions from the military. They don't, for the most part, or they mix them in with their civilian emissions. Now, how else does the Pentagon think about it? Well, they're anticipating bad things happening to their bases. Bad things have already happened, and they've been studying this for a couple of decades. And here's one of their maps of the installations that are already suffering climate-related impacts. Here is Diego Garcia, a U.S. facility in the Indian Ocean, which we lease from Britain. It is vulnerable to sea level rise. Parts of it are only 8 feet above sea level, something like that. Okay, how else do they think about it? They have responded by making a Great Green Fleet. Remember the Great White Fleet? The Great Green Fleet runs on a mix of 10% biofuel, mostly beef fat, and 90% petroleum. That's the Great Green Fleet. And they've also developed carinata seed, that is Ethiopian mustard, to put on aircraft. And there's a 50-50 mix. And in 2008, they showed that they could run their aircraft on this. And people in the Air Force are like, well, we proved it in 2008. Why don't we do this? Okay, that's a question. The other thing they're doing is promoting their sustainability. And they've actually, as I've said, succeeded in reducing their emissions at installations quite a lot. In fact, their reductions are so significant that they've already almost reached their target. In other words, and the Navy said that they would reduce their emissions completely and go net zero by 2050. They have reduced their emissions quite a bit. The Army said that they would reduce their emissions by 50% by 2030. When they published that number based on a 2005 baseline, they had already reduced their emissions by 42%. So they're very close. So there's one way to think about it. They've been ambitious. The other way to think about it is these goals are not ambitious. They're almost already there. All right. But the other thing that I wanted to mention is the securitization of climate change. People are scared that climate change war is coming to a neighborhood near them. And the DOD didn't used to say this, but now they do. The whole National Intelligence Estimate in 2021 focused on this, talked about climate change effects of different levels of warming, and talked about impacts to human security. And these are some: tropical cyclones, effects of biodiversity, effects of rising temperature, precipitation and flooding, causing people to move. Migration is a major concern that they focus on. And then assuming that there will be instability in vulnerable places, they think, as I said, climate change war may be coming to a neighborhood out there or maybe to you. Okay, so then what you see is the Navy again is in the lead, and they say that climate change instability is the threat that they think is more likely. This is Chief of U.S. Pacific Command in 2013, Locklear. It's more likely than other scenarios, including war with China. Okay, and even Secretary of Defense Mattis said needed to be concerned. In 2021, in preparation for the Glasgow meeting, the Conference of the Parties, there were four documents that came out of the government. There was a document by the DOD, their climate risk analysis, where they're anticipating the conflict, where there's climate change caused stresses, and more difficulty in the operating environment. And I'm going to read this one because it's vital here. As climate change converges with other drivers, especially geostrategic competition, emerging technology, and global demographic trends, it is reshaping the risk landscape. An increasingly accessible Arctic has already emerged as a competitive space with national security implications, including competition over resources such as fish, etc. The corrosive impact of these trends will make nations increasingly vulnerable to domestic insecurity, with sweeping implications for regional and border security and core national security interests of the United States, right? Simultaneously, revisionist nations will seek to exploit climate change-induced instability to erode the rules-based order that is central to the security and prosperity of the United States and its allies. So, revisionist nations will seek to erode the rules-based order. That we're talking about there is Russia and China. Then you see in the National Intelligence Estimate, another document that came out at the same time, the focus of their attention right there is Central Africa, which is a region that has produced the least greenhouse gas, but which will be affected greatly. And they're also looking at India, Pakistan, and some island nations as areas that will be highly vulnerable not just to climate change, but to conflict. So the question is that inevitable? Does climate change lead to war? The research shows that that's not necessarily so. It depends on how governments react to the stresses of climate change. And that's where I'm going to end.
That was Nita Crawford, professor in international relations at the University of Oxford. She's the author of The Pentagon, Climate Change and War, Charting the Rise and Fall of U.S. Military Emissions, MIT Press. She spoke at a book release event on September 29, 2022, at Harvard University. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.